Chris, how are you doing?
They've got it to hand out.
I got my tab stuff in child care.
This meeting of the Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. The quorum is present, and Senator Sieben, we're going to begin with Senate File 556.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I do have the A1 amendment.
We're distributing the A1 amendment right now, and
I believe it was in members' packets.
Oh, it is
at
in
least
members'
I got
packets.
It. I got it out of
two
mine.
Of them. I see that.
And
okay, perfect.
Mr. Chair, this is the first committee stop for this bill, so if I could please move that as an author's
Senator
amendment.
Senator Sieben moves the A1 author's amendment to Senate File 556. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. 5% on the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm joined today by Randy Larson, who's a constituent of mine from Cottage Grove. He is here to my right and will testify to his experience. But really, this bill originated from his original email to me, which said that he purchased a snowmobile where the odometer had been rolled back. And once I had council help me look into this issue, realized that unlike on motor vehicles where this is already prohibited, it was not prohibited on snowmobiles. And so that's why I introduced this bill. In the meantime, since then, or even prior to then, I've been working with the Minnesota United Snowmobilers Association. And Mr. Franzen is here and can testify on the bill as before you. The amendment, members, now includes, instead of just snowmobiles, it now includes the major changes. It now includes off-road recreational vehicles. And Mr. Georgiakis, I'm sorry, from Polaris is also here, who is supportive of this bill, is supportive of it including beyond snowmobiles, also off-road recreational vehicles such as ATVs and small motorbikes or motorcycles, not motorcycles that are driven on the road, but the off-road motorcycles. So before I get myself into too much trouble in trying to define what off-road recreational vehicles are, perhaps I'll turn it over to Mr. Larson.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Larson.
Dear Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wish to thank you for allowing me and through me, my fellow snowmobilers, an opportunity to speak to you. I'd also like to thank Senator Sieben for her work on this bill. My name is Randy Larson of Cottage Grove, Minnesota. I started snowmobiling as a teenager back in early 70s. Snowmobiling back then was like the Wild West. Few trails were in existence. There were accidents from drownings, rocks and trees, stumps lay in wait hiding in the fields. Guy wires from telephone poles were common dangers. I myself bear the scars from a run-in with a barbed wire fence. Today, snowmobiling has evolved into a multi-million dollar industry, with over 22,000 miles of safe and beautiful trails drawing thousands of tourists into Minnesota. Thanks to our government here in Minnesota and with the help of MinUSA and all the club members it represents, we have turned the Wild West into a safe and profitable sport. And remarkably enough, we have increased the fun factor. Indeed, snowmobiles themselves have changed, with prices hoovering upwards of $15,000 for a new one. It's be quite an expensive toy. The technology advancements that help to lower the air and noise pollutions have also provided safer and more dependable machines. So it was a great surprise when one of my fellow club members told me how he got cheated when buying a used sled. He did not realize there was no laws preventing odometer turnbacks on snowmobiles or ATVs in Minnesota. I'm gonna let him tell his story separately here. I didn't know if he was going to show up. Basically, he got a sled that had 5,000 miles on it. And if you compare mileage to a car, this would be the equivalent to one that has over 300, or closer to 300,000 miles on it, pretty much the end of life. researching snowmobile forums, talking to other fellow club members, members from other clubs. We have determined that this is not a one individual issue. It's happening with dealers all over, used dealers anyways, I should say. I should also mention a financial reason for approving the bill. At this time, I could not recommend that anybody buy a used snowmobile in Minnesota because they have no guarantee of what they're getting or what they're going to pay for. My advice would be to buy it in one of the majority of states that do not allow odometer setbacks. We sometimes make fun of Minnesota nice, but it is true that the average Minnesotan believes in honesty and integrity. However, when that trust is broken by people that are less than reputable, we often find ourselves taken advantage of. As snowmobilers, we have so many laws, fees, and regulations that we must follow. I ask that you also grant us some protection by supporting this bill. That's it, basically, safety, financial, legally, and morally the right thing to do. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak on behalf of my fellow snowmobilers.
Thank you, Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Brian Marks also would like to testify on this bill. He's in the audience here. And while he's coming up, I should clarify, too, that it's not my intention, nor does this language have anything to do with a new way of titling snowmobiles. I found that is a concern, I guess, and I just wanted to, for the record, to state that I have no intention of at any time messing with the titling of snowmobiles. And I have been told that if I said that would bring great comfort to a large number of people. So.
Senator Sieben, I think this is very similar, what we did many years ago to cars, but more recently with clock hours for farm implements and heavy machinery. But welcome to the committee, sir.
My name is Brian Marks, and I'm from Annandale, Minnesota. Mr. Chair and everybody else. I guess my story, I'll just tell my story. I bought a snowmobile earlier this year from a one-man dealership in St. Paul. He sells about 400 to 500 sleds a year. And when I bought it, it had 500 miles on. He told me it had 500. The odometer said it had 500 on it. I brought it home and was getting ready to ride. It was a couple months later, and I ran into somebody I mentioned his name, and he said, you might want to check this person out. So I took the VIN number. I called Skidoo with it. Skidoo had given me the original owner of the sled. It was a one-owner sled, and I gave him a call, and he said he traded it into a dealership in Michigan, and when he sold it, it had 5,500 miles on. So I called the dealership. The dealership told me who they sold it to. They sold it to a fleet buyer here in St. Paul, and when they sold it had 5,500 miles on it. I ended up calling my bank. I took a loan on it. My bank said if I couldn't get it back, they would take it over on a fraud case, and they'd give me my money back. Now, I did go to them with the sled, told them I was bringing it back, told them, I was prepared to whatever. He did give me my money back on the sled. But since then, I've ran into a lot of people. I've been on the snowmobile forum. You Google this guy's name, the first thing that pops up is buyer beware, and he sells a lot of sleds. He sells a lot of fleet sleds. I just was up in Grand Portage 2 weeks ago, and I ran into a guy in Grand Portage up in the corner of the state who I told him where I was from, and he said, have you ever heard of this guy? And they've heard of him. He's from Thunder Bay, because also in Canada, it's a big no-no to roll him back too, and this guy's also in some trouble up in Canada, but... I'm kind of got this ball rolling, and I don't know. I guess that's kind of my story.
Thank you, Senator Sieben. Any others, Mr. Franzen?
Mr. Franzen.
Mr. Franzen, welcome to the committee.
In USA.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senators. My name is Doug Franzen. I'm an attorney representing Minnesota United Snowmobilers Association, the statewide association of snowmobilers. And we want to thank Senator Sieben for bringing forth this legislation. It's a good bill that corrects a statutory oversight. When we shared this with our friends from the ATV, off-road motorcycle, and off-road truck community, they also supported it, hence the amendment where these groups are included as well. I know Ray Bowen from the ATV folks at BAM is here if you'd like to hear from them, but or you could take my word they like it too. This comes under the consumer fraud section. It's something that's long overdue, and frankly, I was surprised when it came to our attention that turning back or tampering with an odometer fraudulently with intent to defraud was not against the law. It's a simple, straightforward response to that omission. It does not burden the snowmobile owner, the seller, or the buyer with unneeded bureaucracy. It's a really great bill. Thank you, Senator Steven. It has our wholehearted support.
Thank you. And are there any questions from members of the committee? I think this is a fairly routine thing. I mean, it surprises me, too, that we haven't covered every kind of equipment. We did it with the clock hours for the, again, the machinery that's operated by hours instead of miles. But this will cover a lot more than we've had in the past. Senator Sieben, we have a request from the bill from Judiciary Committee. I kind of assumed it was going to Commerce. We haven't heard from them. Have you heard?
Yes, I have heard that Commerce would like to see it as well.
And I assume Commerce should get it before Judiciary, but that's your preference.
That was my understanding.
Senator Sieben, is there anybody else in the audience who needed to speak to the bill? Oh, Mr. Georgicus.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chris Georgicus. I'm here to represent Polaris Industries, one of two Minnesota-based worldwide manufacturers of snowmobiles, ATVs, and side-by-side vehicles. Mr. Chairman, I'm here simply to register Polaris's full support for Senator Sieben's bill as amended to ensure integrity in the used marketplace for snowmobiles, ATVs, and side-by-side vehicles. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Georgicus. Questions from the committee? If not, Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 556 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce. Any discussion of that notion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we have Senator Herr, Clean Water Expenditures Authorization. This is a PCA agency bill, I believe.
Hello, Mr. Chair, member, and you are correct. This is the MPCA policy bill, Senate 5423. And this is this bill is to propose modification to numerous legislative reports and also repeal obsolete rules and make a few corrections. It may take a while for our time to explain and discuss this, so, you know, having next to me here is Mr. Kurt Kadelka, Assistant to Commissioner of MPCA. So, Mr. Kurt.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee, Commissioner Kadelka.
Oh, and we have amendment coming around.
Is this the one that's listed as A130140?
That's correct.
Two amendments in the pack. We'll deal with that one first. Senator Herr moves the 0140 amendment. Is an author's amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Mr. Chair, I'd like also to make an oral amendment to this amendment.
Mr. Kadelka, are you going to explain what you're trying to get to this amendment?
Sure. Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We on the back side of the A13-0140 amendment. This is language we've worked on with a number of stakeholders to bring peace in the valley on the issue. And we would like on 2.1, after the comma, to delete the words, but is not limited to, and replace it with may include.
Okay. So the language on 2.1 would be page 5, line 13, delete institutional controls and insert may include. That will be incorporated into the amendment, if so. Senator Herr moves the A.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I think the way you repeated it wasn't the way I heard it. I thought, and I apologize, Mr. Chair.
No, please go ahead.
I thought that we were on line 2.1, deleting after the comma, but is not limited to. And I think you spoke to institutional controls.
No, I said delete institutional controls. I was reading the line as it would read and insert.
Thank you.
Quote, comma, may include. Is that what you want?
That's correct, Senator.
I may have said that wrong. That's what it was. Okay. Senator Herr incorporates that into the 0140 amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. You have another amendment.
That's correct.
0107.
Oh, yep. 813-0107.
Okay, we'll fix it. Senator Herr moves the 0107 amendment, much longer one here. Any discussion on that amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Where is it?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senate Counsel has some questions about the earlier amendments, whether it fits in right, and maybe you could. Mr. Knopf?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Kudelka, when you eliminate, but it's not limited to, say may include. You still have the word includes in the bill itself. If you look at 5.13, it says corrective action includes institutional controls. We're deleting institutional controls, and we're adding may include. And I think
you want to delete the word includes as well. So Senator Herr moves on page 5, line 13 of the bill to delete the word includes. Any discussion on that? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now you want to go ahead and explain the bill with the amendments and everything. Mr. Kudelka, are you going to do it?
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee members, real quickly, we'll work off to start with, there's a handout in everyone's packet, the MPCA policy bill, just to go through the provisions in the original bill, and then I can touch on the amendments. The amendments are two pieces of the governor's budget that are the policy provisions that need to make various stops in the policy committees, including government operations, state and local government, that we would like to attach on now so that it can make the proper stops in time for action in the Finance Committee. As the author mentioned, this bill is our policy bill. It has a numerous changes in legislative reports and repealing some obsolete rules and then making some small policy changes. Section 1 of the bill deals with the Clean Water Fund project partnership agreements. Currently, there are a number of requirements in the use of any legacy dollars to report things such as FTEs and other data. When we work with many stakeholders, we can put these in our contracts that we draw up and collect that information from them very easily, and that's not a problem. When we start working on a match with the federal government, those contracts need to go back to D.C. and get approval, which adds time and a lot of administrative work. What we'd like to do is use the Fed's project partnership agreements, which are already in place, and then just on the side ask for the information that we must reply back to the legislature on. We will collect the same amount of information, just the manner in which we're doing it is different. The next part of the sheet is the petroleum environmental covenants. That's sections 5 through 8 and section 10 in the bill. Right now, this provision would allow the agency to carry out environmental covenants as allowed under Chapter 114E for the petroleum remediation program. Currently, our voluntary investigation and cleanup program, which is very close to our petroleum program in style, and also the Superfund program has this specific language. This allows MPCA to implement an environmental covenant that may require protective measures instead of some cleanup options. This could include, we may ask for a cap over exposure, 2 feet of soil, so that the property owner, if they can't get all of the material underneath in the spill, they could cap it and reduce any exposure. We would just put an environmental covenant that soil cannot be disturbed unless there's an approval through the MPCA. or a requirement that a remediation system continue to operate through the duration of the property. This is a non-fee, non-possessory interest in the land. It's similar to a lien, and this is something that we can't impose on ourselves without consent of the property owner. What this does is gives a property owner an option. In cases where we can't get all the pollution, we will ask for other type of protective measures to ensure the public health and the environment is still protected. The other changes in the bill are a number of legislative reports. We right now have a Superfund report that's done on an annual basis. We ask to do it once every 2 years to match up with the budgetary cycle. It also we also have other work plans that we submit to agencies. The other one is the Metropolitan Landfill Contingency Action Trust Account report. We ask to repeal that. Currently, this is a fund that's being collected in the metropolitan area for long-term care of landfills. At this point, there's no dollars coming out of those funds, so the report is not mentioning anything other than a fund statement. It's a glorified fund statement that we do already, so we're asking for that just to be removed. We don't expect any expenditures from this fund until at least 2040, and at that time we can reexamine whether we need to do reporting. The final issue in the bill is the repealers. Each year, all agencies are required to do an obsolete rules report. And last year, also, the agency and the other conservation agencies were requested to go through all of our rules and put together a report on ways to streamline. The report identified a number of areas, and the three of them here, we are asking that the legislature help us just outright appeal. The other suggestions will work through the rulemaking process. They need more tweaks. It's not as simple as just repealing a subdivision in the, or sub-part of the rules. We have to parse back together sentences and such that aren't doesn't work well with the repeal process. That's the bill as it stands. Real quick then to the two amendments, the 813-0140 is the wastewater lab certification program. This is part of the governor's budget for the agency. What we are doing currently, the Department of Health has a program that a while back we used for drinking water and wastewater needs. As the needs of the drinking water program increased, so do the requirements and other things that local communities had to do. And so if a wastewater lab was in the program and only needed for wastewater, they were doing stuff above and beyond what they needed to satisfy our needs. After discussions with the Department of Health and the users of this, we've decided to split it apart. The end result will be still protecting public health and the environment. Quality assurance and control will still be met under this program for wastewater labs. However, it will be easier for these labs to go through the process if they're just doing wastewater. So this is a streamlining and savings for these labs. It's just us changing to make it fit correct. On the backside of that amendment, as I mentioned, we met with the stakeholders regarding the petroleum environmental covenants. This is language that we all worked out to address concerns that we heard in the Environment Policy Committee. The second amendment is the 813-0107. Again, this is a part of the governor's budget. Currently, right now, sanitary district formation is done by the agency. What we're proposing to do is move this to the Office of Administrative Hearings. They deal very frequently with municipal boundary changes. They're experts in this. What we're proposing to do is moving that administrative formation or modification or dissolution of a sanitary district to those who do this every day compared to us, who we all may do it one or two every 5 years. And it's, again, the idea here is to streamline it, put it in the hands of the expert, right-size government again. Mr. Chair and committee members, that is the bill.
Are there questions from members of the committee? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we would turn to page 6 of the bill, which would be item 11 under subdivision 4, section 7, it talks about condemnation proceedings essentially giving the right of eminent domain to the agency. And I was just wondering, right now eminent domain is possible for the state of Minnesota for pursuit of acquisition of property for public use. Is there some reason under current law that you would be precluded from exercising that?
Mr. Chair and committee members, under the 014 amendment. We have stricken that language using the condemnation process. That was one of the things when discussing with stakeholders. What we did here is cut and paste the language from the Superfund program. That's not needed for the petroleum remediation, so we have deleted that language in the amendment.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Are there any? Is there anybody in the audience who wanted to speak with concerns about the bill? Is there any further discussion from members of the committee? Senator Brown.
Yes. I have a question on the A13 amendment. When Kentucky was going through this, they held a series of stakeholder meetings regarding their wastewater laboratory certification. I'm just wondering if Minnesota has facilitated any stakeholder discussion meetings on this issue.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is something that has come before the legislature 2 years ago by the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities and others. We've been working with Department of Health and stakeholders since then. I'm not familiar with the process you've mentioned in other states, so I can't say how we compare to their process, unfortunately. Sorry.
Jim Brown.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question. Are the individual engineers in these laboratories also certified, or is it just a broad certification for the entire lab?
Mr. Cadell.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I believe it is the laboratories and the work they do, so the individuals underneath it would be covered, but I will need to double-check to ensure that that's correct. I can get back to you and the committee.
And one more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this going to generate new revenue for the department?
Mr. Chair and committee members, currently through the Department of Health, these labs do charge are charged a fee and are paying it. It would be new revenue to the department. However, it would be less to the end user. The cost would be a reduction to them, and the cost would only be under this language to cover our program needs.
Further discussion on the bill? If not, this bill goes to the judiciary. If not, Senator Herr moves that Senate File 423, as amended, be recommended to pass. And I believe the Judiciary Committee is requested to see this and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair, members.
Thank you. Senator Eaton, Senate File 639.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an author's amendment.
Okay, it's in the packets. This is the 0153.
Correct.
By the way, I will encourage members and the agencies and others they're working with, when we have amendments for committee, if they're drafted by the revisor, at least sharing with Senate counsel sometimes can help, because when they have other amendments from others. This is fine to work with, but it's helpful, I think, in general, if authors bring amendments to Senate counsel, even if they're drafted by the revisor.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Senator Eat moves the 0153 amendment. So there is an author's amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill on product stewardship programs, and we're basically talking about paint, batteries, and carpet, and I will let the experts here explain the details. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Garth Hickel. I'm the product stewardship team leader with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. First off, I would like to thank the committee for hearing the bill today. All of these products have been under significant scrutiny and interest from the agency as well as a range of other stakeholders, and I'd like to particularly recognize the engagement that we've received thus far from the various trade associations, individual manufacturers, as well as feedback from local government recyclers and other key stakeholders in Minnesota. It is one bill, but it does have three distinct sections, one for each product. There are similarities between the products, but some very important distinctions between the various sections. It is a transition for product stewardship programs in Minnesota with a focus on outcomes with manufacturer-developed stewardship plans submitted to the PCA as a centerpiece that offers significant flexibility to develop programs, so it is not a prescriptive, regulatory-driven approach. We really place an emphasis on manufacturer, managed, and finance programs with MPCA serving in a broader oversight role. The need for legislation is essentially to ensure a level playing field, provide accountability, and importantly, support industry collaboration through an exemption through state antitrust regulations. Section 2 addresses carpet specifically. It's meant to reduce the amount of carpet that is being disposed of annually in the state, which the MPCA estimates is at about 86,000 tons. The language is modeled on a very successful program in California that was enacted by their legislature in 2010 that has resulted in an increased recycling rate for carpet and created new business opportunities. There is a stewardship organization that exists in California, the Carpet America Recovery Effort, or CARE, and we expect that same organization to be functioning in Minnesota. Manufacturers are required to participate in the program, and there is a do not sell provision in place to ensure compliance. So, in other words, manufacturers and retailers are not able to sell products unless those manufacturers of those products are participating in an approved stewardship plan. The stewardship plan outlines the collection and recycling strategy as well as education and outreach plan and other important elements for the program, and that is due in 2015. The plan does propose five-year goals that are determined by specific criteria laid out in the bill, and ultimately that plan is reviewed and approved by the agency. There is an important element in the stewardship planning process whereby the stewardship organization is required to consult with local government, recyclers, and retailers who do have and obviously have a stake in the ultimate program. And then there is an annual reporting function by the stewardship organization to the agency as a mechanism for tracking progress. Section 3 addresses specifically architectural paint. It is the largest volume and greatest expense for the county household hazardous waste programs in the state. The language proposes essentially the same program that is currently functioning in Oregon and California and will be soon in Connecticut and Rhode Island. Paint Care is the existing stewardship organization, and the assumption is that they will take the lead in developing the stewardship plan and implementing the program in Minnesota. It is likely to build on the existing HHW infrastructure. However, based on the experience in Oregon and California, we expect that there will be significantly expanded collection opportunities for Minnesota residents through voluntary retail collection. It is funded by, for both paint and carpet, funded by a stewardship assessment that is ultimately paid by consumers. So that is the important funding mechanism for both paint and carpet. Primary batteries, which are typically your A, AA's, or D cells, is in Section 4 of the bill. And the industry leadership on this issue is notable, and they have a longstanding relationship with Hennepin County in particular that is currently serving as one of the demonstration sites for modeling product stewardship activities nationally. Based on 2010 sales, prorated national sales, the MPC estimates that there are nearly 100 million primary batteries sold in Minnesota annually. And this represents about 98% of battery sales to consumers. Unfortunately, many consumers are not able to tell the difference between primary batteries and rechargeable batteries, and so we really view this as an excellent opportunity to complement the existing product stewardship statute for rechargeable batteries in Minnesota that has been in place for nearly 20 years. And so as a result of this, we expect to significantly increase the collection of rechargeables, as has been demonstrated in other jurisdictions that have added primary batteries after first starting with rechargeable batteries. A stewardship plan, like the other products, it needs to be developed with specified performance goals, a description of the collection infrastructure, and then ultimately that is reviewed and approved by the agency. As opposed to both paint and carpet, there is no specified stewardship assessment funding mechanism and instead will be managed by the manufacturers. There is an annual reporting requirement, so again, we're able to track annual progress towards meeting the goals that are laid out in the stewardship plan. There are two other important provisions to touch on. One is the MPCA report to the legislature on functioning of programs that will be folded into one of the existing agency reports. And then secondly is that any of the agency's oversight responsibilities are funded by an administrative fee that is based on actual program costs. At this point, the agency estimates that it will require 1.2 FTE to administer the bill as written.
Thank you, Mr. Hickel. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Eaton, is there a fiscal note available with this bill?
Not yet.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton, under each section for paint, carpet, and batteries, there's a section titled Administrative Fee. Could you explain those sections to me, please?
So I know what I'm talking about.
Page 7, line 7.9.
I think we just got the answer there.
Mr. Hickel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, the agency does project that it will cost about approximately $165,000 annually to manage the program. So that translates into about 1.5 FTE. As I referenced, however, at this point, that is just an estimate. The cost potentially could be lower than that, particularly going forward, after we move through the product stewardship plan development process.
Senator Brown.
Two questions. Do consumers pay this cost ultimately, and what is the overall cost to consumers on the fees that will be added on when they purchase these products at retailers or whatever? What will the overall yearly cost to consumers be, and who's paying the administrative fees? Senator Eaton, could you offer some input on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, the manufacturers will be providing a stewardship assessment for both paint and carpet. In the case of the program in California for carpet, it adds an additional 5 cents per square yard. And in Oregon, I believe that the per gallon assessment is 75 cents.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know, Senator Eaton, if you have any comments on this, but what will it be in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, I assume it'll be comparable.
Well, we went from 5 cents to 75 cents. That's a big difference.
On different products.
Ours has been consistent. I'm David Darling with American Coatings Association, and I can speak to the paint issue. It has been consistent. We've now had two states on board, and it's been the same price. We intend to, we have all hopes to keep that consistent here in Minnesota.
Okay, so forgive, Mr. Chair, forgive my last question, but again, reiterate to me what the yearly cost to consumers will be.
For the paint program, assuming I think it's a gallon per person, 75 cents.
But do we have a total, based on the amount of paint that's purchased in Minnesota, what is that, and carpet and batteries, what is that total cost to consumers going to be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, that's difficult to project. In California, the assessment is raising a total of about $5 million annually for a population of 35 or 36 million people.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps either Senator Eaton or Mr. Chair, you may have some institutional knowledge of this, too, when we pass the electronics bill. And if there was a cost to that for the PCA to do their reporting, maybe perhaps Mr. Knopf can answer that question. How was that bill set up? Did we have the batteries and the electronics in the same bill, or were they separate? I'm interested in knowing about the reporting and how it was set up, what the report shows, if it's been successful, Mr. Knopf, and I might have to dig that report up to see if we're accomplishing what we've, the intent of the bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, you may want to get that from the agency. As far as I know, that's been a very successful program, and there were fees that were charged as a part of that, too, to the agency. To administer the program. But I think Mr. Hickel actually can talk quite a bit about that program.
Mr. Chair, if you wouldn't mind if I could ask that question for Mr. Hickel, if you understood the question, Mr. Hickel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, the electronics program is just simply focused on video display devices, so monitors, televisions, and laptops. As a result of that, the state is currently collecting about 6 pounds per capita annually, which is quite comparable to the other leading states, Washington, Oregon, Vermont, New York, and so forth. In terms of the fee, there is an actual annual registration fee that manufacturers pay to register with the agency, and that funds the agency's administrative costs, and that is based on the number of sales on a unit basis into the state. So it's either $2,500 or $1,250. However, we feel that actually charging for the actual program management costs, frankly, is a more equitable way to address the agency's costs for managing the program rather than just setting a flat fee in statute.
Mr. Chair, are there, Mr. Hinkle, are there other programs out there that collect batteries for free?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, there is a statute that requires the rechargeable battery manufacturers to operate a collection program in the state that is funded by the rechargeable battery manufacturers. Those collection options are typically at retail as well as some municipal locations. But unfortunately, that a similar program does not exist for primary batteries, which are the most prevalent batteries used by consumers.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hinkle, I'm going to kind of put you on the spot a little bit. Is this the other states that have done something similar to this? Are they pushing another agenda now that they have this in place? Are you going to start seeing an increase in the fees, more mandates in any way that's possible? I mean, this does cause some angst as far as what we could see coming down the pipeline. And I'd like to know what the other states that have this in place, what their agenda going forward is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, it's difficult for me to speculate on the motivations that may be underway in other states. It's my understanding that for primary batteries, that simply Minnesota and California are the two states that are looking at this issue in 2013. Up to this point, no other states have enacted a statute requiring product stewardship for primary batteries. But we feel that, again, that if we're really going to get a successful collection program for rechargeable batteries, as well as being able to harvest some of the valuable materials that are in primary batteries, that we need to move forward with a statutory approach that ensures a level playing field for all the manufacturers.
And Mr. Hinkle? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Hinkle, I mean, if you've already got the electronics in place, do we actually need to have 1.5 FTEs? That seems, I mean, sometimes don't you think that the department can absorb a little of this? We go through this in healthcare all the time, report here, report there, and pretty soon you're spending $2-3 million on reports, and I just wondered if this is something that the department could absorb.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, we are devoting approximately 1.5 FTE to administering the Minnesota Electronics Recycling Act right now. So I think being able to address three programs for 1.5 FTE is actually relatively efficient. Now, having said that, as I mentioned, once we actually move through the initial product stewardship planning process, we very well may be able to reduce the number of staff that we are needing to devote to the three products.
Senator Benson, and then we'd like to have the witnesses in support and opposition. Go ahead.
To that point, please. Mr. Chair, you mentioned the electronics program takes 1.5 FTEs, and when this is rolling, you think you'll be able to step down the number of personnel. Did you step down the personnel once the electronics recycling program got rolling?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, we have not been able to, because of the requirements that are in statute, particularly pertaining to the registration and reporting requirements. So part of our interest in moving forward this approach is that we actually believe that a stewardship planning model, such as indicated by these three different products, will actually be much less administratively intensive for the agency and will result in more flexibility and thus improved environmental outcomes.
And
Senator.
Mr. Chair, and I apologize, Mr. Hinkle, it looks to me like the nonprofits set up by each of these groups are required to submit the plans. So you're saying it's going to take half of a person's time for an entire year to review these plans? Is that my understanding?
Mr. Hickel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, that is our projection based on several of the other states that have implemented similar statutes. But again, our intent is that we will be able to do this with the minimal amount of staffing. We want to ensure that, obviously, that there are some of these organizations, the stewardship organizations, do not have active experience in Minnesota. They certainly don't understand the players, the context, and the landscape. And so the agency does feel, particularly during the stewardship planning process, that we will need to be actively involved and ensuring that the data that the agency has and so forth are readily available. But again, as I said, I think that the hope is in the future that we will be able to administer this with even fewer staff.
Thank you. We have a lot of people wishing to testify to the bill. Senator Eaton, you want to call them whatever order you'd like?
Speak?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is David Darling, and I'm with the American Coatings Association. ACA is a trade organization. We represent all types of coating manufacturers, including manufacturers of house paint. ACA created Paint Care. It's a nonprofit organization to implement an end-of-life management program for post-consumer paint. The legislation in front of you is a result of a five-year stakeholder dialogue with numerous interested stakeholders, including the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and local HHW programs in the state. This bill and the program itself was designed specifically for paint. It may or may not work for other products. It's really crafted carefully for the unique issues related to leftover paint. A product stewardship approach is, we believe that a product stewardship approach is one where all participants involved in the life cycle of the product take a shared responsibility. That includes the production, the sale, the use, and the end-of-life management. As was mentioned earlier, legislation is necessary so that we can ensure a level playing field, that all producers participate, and that there's a sustainable financing system. Unless all manufacturers and retailers participate in the program, it's likely that it's going to lead to unfair competitive advantages and disadvantages among producers and retailers. And we also need a legislation to deal with when it comes to the financing system, because as competitors, we really can't have them argue or talk about the price of products. Because that, or the price of services, because that would run afoul of antitrust regulations. This legislation ensures a transparent financing system and gives limited protection from antitrust regulations. The financing system is where paint manufacturers pay an assessment for every container sold in Minnesota. That payment goes to Paint Care, and the assessment is passed down through the chain of sale chain down through the wholesale retail so that distributors and retailers are made whole. Paint Care then takes those funds and they collect the paint, recycle it, and properly dispose of latex and oil-based paint. As mentioned earlier, Paint Care, we also establish more collection sites, both HHW and paint retail stores, and that provides more convenience for residents all over the state. The program is currently operating in Oregon and California, and we intend to implement the program in Connecticut and Rhode Island later this year. In Oregon, after 2 years of operation, we've established 100 collection sites. We've collected and processed over 1 million gallons of coatings of paint and recycled over 100 tons of plastic and metal containers. You have my full testimony as well as a fact sheet on the Paint Care program in front of you. We have a number of letters of support from several paint manufacturers, including Valspar and Hirschfields. Both companies are located here in Minnesota. I am aware that or heard that there's interest in aerosol products. However, we have not added aerosols in this or any of our other programs yet. Because of safety concerns, cost, liability, regulatory issues. And then the other concern with aerosols is that paint, you know, there's a lot of aerosols out there. Paint is only a subset. And essentially, to essentially get into the aerosol market, we'd have to pull in all the various types of aerosols, and that would be tough to manage. In advance, thank you for your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank you, Mr. Darling, for the your work as part of your association, because I think it's a great thing that the manufacturers are coming together with the Pollution Control Agency to come up with a program that your industry is comfortable with, and I think that that can bring comfort to us as policymakers and also to consumers to know that when they're buying paint, after this program is established, there'll be a much clearer way for responsible stewardship of the remaining paint products.
So. Thank you.
Further questions? If not, Senator Eaton, you wanted Mr. Freeman next?
Sure.
Madam Cap, just
Freeman and Trudy Richter.
Mr. Freeman and Ms. Richter, welcome to the committee.
Hi.
You may have to speak up because it's kind of noisy out there.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for listening to me today. My name is Ed Freeman. I'm the CFO at Brotex Company. We are a 90-year-old manufacturer, family-owned business based in St. Paul. We've been in the textile recycling business since 1923. We've been recycling post-consumer carpet since 2006 and have processed over 34 million pounds of carpet over the past 3 years, over 14 million pounds last year, diverting 33% of that amount from the landfills. The other 67% is still a waste from our process, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. Our byproducts from this activity go into engineered resins and the plastics industry in various forms for molding and extruded products. Some of the largest industries are automotive, and some is also going back into the carpet industry. We have three processes for dealing with the post-consumer carpet. We shear the carpet. We separate the nylon facing from the backing. We grind polypropylene and polyester carpets for use in some of the plastics industries there. And we also extrude some of the nylon waste that we process from the shearing operation as well as some post-industrial materials we are collecting. We currently employ 32 people in the carpet recycling area of the 90 that we employ. And for about every 5 million pounds that we add to our processing, we would need about 15 additional jobs. We currently operate in two shifts. And we feel if you're throwing away the carpet, you're throwing away the jobs. For carpet recycling to be successful, we need to have a revenue stream to offset some of the collection process. We have over 40 sites around Minnesota and some of the neighboring states. We have 135 partners that we're collecting carpet from. We need to recover the cost of the disposal after we harvest the nylon from the process. Our waste cost last year was about $370,000 for the 9 million pounds that were not going into product. Some of that was burned. One of the things that we would look for, you know, in developing down the road is the ability to consider burning not as waste. Instead of having to pay for that, we would look for the opportunity to deliver it to some facilities that can take the product as an energy, waste to energy. Some of the possible uses that are still being developed to make this initiative successful for us and others in the industry are plastics to oil applications, as well as other applications for some of the other materials other than nylon in products. Again, for us to for this industry, recycling to be very successful and sustainable, we need to have a solution for the back end of the product as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Questions from the committee. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Freeman, thank you, too, for your work on this. I'm curious how this would work, how this works for consumers. I heard that you say there are, did you say 40 centers? And so
we have 40 about 40 different collection sites around the area.
Like, I think of the time I got new carpet, my hauler obviously didn't take it. We wanted to tear up the carpet ourselves to save the money instead of having the new carpet person install it. So what's the plan in terms of educating the public about where they take their carpet or working with haulers, or how does that work?
We are working with various collectors around the installers. We do have a container dumpster at our facility. We ask for donation when people drop off their carpet. At this point, we are interested in post-consumer carpet as opposed to commercial. And we try to educate the people about how much oil we're saving by recycling the carpet. You know, in some of the handout that I have for you, we've got some information from our Carpet Industry Association CARE, which talks about how much oil you save by being able to recycle the carpet as opposed to making new carpet. And that's what we're trying to educate the consumers about, that you need to look at cradle to cradle on this and not just buying it and disposing it and throwing energy or throwing resources away.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, and maybe the answer is the PCA will be helpful in this, but I still don't
quite understand, like, is it the, when you buy new carpet, will they advise consumers of where they can recycle their carpet? Or how would just your average citizen, once this is implemented, know that Brotex exists to know where to take the carpet?
Mr. Hickel, welcome back.
If you want to take that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, one of the specific components of the product stewardship plan is for the stewardship organization to identify what that education and outreach strategy is. There is also a requirement for the manufacturers to provide retailers with information about the available collection options and so forth. That may be through establishing a 1-800 number, a web-based tools, what have you. We didn't feel that the agency really wanted to specify what those specific means of communication would be, but it would be presumably a partnership between the Carpet America recovery effort, retailers, as well as installers and processors that are operating in the state.
Thank Mr. you. Chair, I just wanted to add that the right now this is being done by the counties, and we are paying for it with our taxes. The 2.4% of the municipal solid waste is carpet. It's a this would just put the onus back on the manufacturers, basically.
What percentage of carpeting is wool versus nylon? You're only recycling the nylon, I think you said, right?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, what we are seeing right now is about 55% of the carpet out there is nylon, about 15% is polypropylene, 15% or so is polyester. Wool is a very small piece of it at this point. The trend in the industry probably is towards a little bit more polyester as opposed to nylon because of the cost.
Thank you. Further questions, if not Ms. Richter and then Ms. Garlitz? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Trudy Richter, and I am the administrator for the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board. And that is a six-county joint powers board with two commissioners from each of the six counties in the metropolitan area, exclusive of Scott County. The commissioners asked me to come comment on this bill today and are sorry they themselves could not be here. Many are at NACO, the National Association of Counties, and some have county board meetings on Tuesday. So I'm pleased to be here on their behalf, and we wanted to let you all know that we have for a long time have supported product stewardship. We are very much in support of this bill. We want to thank the MPCA for its leadership and the important changes that were just put in the amendment, including the fact that putting together the stewardship plan, the manufacturers will have to have a discussion of how the existing household hazardous waste infrastructure will be considered. Because, as the senator indicated, this is something that has fallen on counties for many, many years to manage materials that cannot be landfilled, should not be landfilled, have special characteristics that need to be managed in a special way. We have worked on paint for many years with legislative support and once again are very much in support of this. I do have one question. Because of needing to respond and report during the first year of the program, the counties need to have an understanding, specifically with paint, as to what is included in the architectural paint definition and what perhaps isn't. We want to be sure that lacquers, varnishes, and stains are included. And we did note that Paint Care did comment on aerosols. The notes I took indicated that they haven't added aerosols in due to their safety issues, cost issues, and regulatory concerns. We share those, and this will be left then with counties to have to pay using taxpayers' dollars. We believe there are a lot of aerosols, and we're hopeful that Paint Care could indicate that it's actively working on trying to find a way to develop a way of managing the aerosols as well. But thank you for the opportunity to let you all know how supportive we are of product stewardship and specifically these three materials.
Thank you, Ms. Richter. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Richter, if I may ask, why is not Scott County part of the coalition?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, they were at one point and chose to opt out many, many years ago. We all are under the same policy plan and do the same work related to solid waste. They've chosen to do it on their own rather than to work regionally with the programs that we work on as the six counties together. The specific politics of it, I can't speak to, sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Rosen.
I would assume, Ms. Richter, there is a cost savings to have six counties together working in the same direction.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we believe there is definitely. We have common communications programs, educational programs for taxpayers, our residents, and our businesses that we develop regionally, and then the individual counties also use those messages. We approach public policy issues jointly. We work on registering and licensing the haulers jointly. Yes, there are many, many benefits of the group working together.
Thank you. And on that note, I know that Association of Counties used to have 86 of 87 counties. I think you now represent all 87, Ms. Garlitz.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Annalie Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and we do represent all 87 counties in the state. I would also like to thank the Pollution Control Agency and Senator Eaton for bringing forward the bill and the amendment that was brought up today. Counties have been involved in encouraging and promoting product stewardship for many years, and we are supportive of the framework for paint, carpet, and batteries put forward in this bill. We feel it's a step in a positive direction. And as we work with the product stewardship organizations to develop the agreements set forward in the bill, we're hopeful that we can develop some equitable programs and access for all counties and their citizens to recycle these products. We also hope, as Ms. Richter said, that we can work towards including more products such as aerosol paint in the future as we continue these discussions. I know that Ms. Thibodeau from Chisago County is also here to represent the Solid Waste Administrators Association. And I will end my testimony and maybe ask that she can testify next so she can explain a little bit more about solid waste administrator participation and kind of what solid waste administrators do with the recycling of paint in their counties.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Thibodeau.
Thank you very much. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Lisa Thibodeau, and I'm the solid waste administrator for Chisago County. I'm here today representing Minnesota Solid Waste Administrators Association, or SWA. I am the executive secretary of the board. For many years, SWA has supported the concept of product stewardship. It's to us, it's just a common sense approach to design a product to be less toxic or with the end of life in mind so that when you're done with it, you can recycle it and keep it in the economy instead of disposing of it forever and taking it out of the system. The counties are, as you all know, the counties are charged with protecting the health of our citizens and our environment. According to Statute 115A, the Waste Management Act, we are to accomplish this through, if you read the Waste Management Act right in the beginning, it says through reduction in toxicity, recovery of materials, and reduction of indiscriminate disposal of waste, among other things. So that's a solid waste administrator's job. That's what I do. The Waste Management Act also creates a waste hierarchy for which all disposal in the state is governed by. And the top of the hierarchy list is reduction and reuse, followed by recycling. That's what product stewardship is. SWA feels that this bill for product stewardship of carpet, paint, and batteries would be beneficial, would help to get product stewardship off the ground for these three materials. SWA does have questions about how this will all play out. As you know, the devil's in the details, and most of the details of these programs will come after the legislation and be worked out in the product stewardship plan, and the benefits may not be equal for all counties. So while I would also like to see other materials added to the list down the road, such as aerosols. But overall, SWA appreciates the industry's willing to take this on, and we are willing to trust that they and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency will take our concerns into consideration to come up with a good program that benefits the citizens of the state of Minnesota. And the benefits are creating more opportunity for residents to recycle these items in the counties by helping local economies out, by keeping these products in the system, and by helping us local governments out by paying part of the cost for managing these materials. Chisago County has no official position on this legislation, but our disposal costs would come down with the paint and the battery product stewardship, and our local landfill at the East Central Solid Waste Commission would save money on carpet recycling. So thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators.
Thank you, Ms. Thibodeau. Questions? If not, thank you very much. And Ms. Peterson. Then we have Mr. Quillis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Molly Peterson, Government Affairs Director for Conservation Minnesota. I am also here to testify in support of Senate File 639. Conservation Minnesota views this bill as sort of a natural extension of the work done in previous years to deal with problem materials in the waste stream. And much like the electronics waste program now in place, this bill lays the groundwork for dealing with these three persistent problems. Too often, these products are ending up in landfills or with paint. They're dumped down the drain by consumers simply because they aren't aware of any other options for disposal. And just by nature of the name of our organization, Conservation Minnesota, we frequently get calls from Minnesotans wondering, what can I do with paint? What can I do with my batteries? We think that Minnesotans really do want to do the right thing and responsibly recycle or dispose of these things. And we believe that the provisions in Senate File 639 will lead to less materials ending up in landfills or in our water. We appreciate Senator Eaton's leadership, and we appreciate Mr. Hickel and the Pollution Control Agency for working with stakeholders. And we thank you in advance for your support.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson. Questions from the committee? If not, Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I wanted to thank you for your time today to comment on Senator Eaton's bill, and it's not going to come as a shock to you that the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is very supportive of the keyword being voluntary programs in the state of Minnesota dealing with waste management. And we support voluntary programs that educate manufacturers, retailers, and consumers of their responsibility of at various stages of a product's lifestyle. And I'll give you an example of a willingness for us to participate and lead in this issue area is we have an affiliate at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce called Minnesota WasteWise. It is an award-winning program, has over 640 companies that have participated, and they lead in helping companies. The motto is less waste is smart business. And it helps companies reduce waste, save costs related to waste management. And they have a unique ability to go through and have some companies that have waste issues and to be able to match them up if some company is getting rid of cardboard at this spot when they go through and do a waste audit with them. There might be another company that's looking for that particular product. And that is one of their success stories of where they've been able to help one company out with a end product and match them up with somebody else that needs that. And so I just wanted to point that out to you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. And then finally, in your discussions as you go through and talk about waste management issues, you know, each product, and I think you've heard a little bit of it today, and you're going to hear a little bit more of it from folks who are going to testify behind me in regarding, you've heard it a little bit in terms of paint and what kind of lacquers and aerosols there are. And I think you're going to hear it also from, there's some folks from the battery and carpet associations, I think, are going to also testify behind me. But each product is unique in itself, and there's not a one-size-that-fits-all. There's not a boilerplate you can go through and do this. And I'll just give you an example, and hopefully the battery folks can articulate it a little bit farther. But and we danced around it a little bit. In terms of batteries, there's regular batteries, or what we call primary batteries. There's rechargeable batteries. There's button batteries. It's in your watch. It's in our Blackberries. As a matter of fact, I think you're going to have a little bit of a conversation, and I haven't had it yet, but at the pace we're going right now, some people have them in pacemakers in their hearts and in their little button batteries. And so as you go through, keep those in mind that they're in medical devices, they're in watches, they're in your Blackberries, they're in my daughter's princess castle that I brought her over Christmas. So as you go through there's not a boilerplate, then we can go through and look at that. And so each product as you go through is unique, and I just wanted to remind you of that in your deliberations as you go through, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your time, and I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Quillis, and perhaps you or somebody else can answer this question. How does Minnesota rate when it comes to our recycling and the progress that we made? I'm not from here. I was born and raised in Colorado, and it seems like we trump all the states around, even Colorado, on recycling. And perhaps, you know, this is the direction we're going, but again, it's another tax. It's going to be another fee on there, and I just wonder if we've already got in place some pretty substantial aggressive programs that are working, and we're just trying to ramp this up with adding some costs on that are going to make people be more creative in other areas of their purchases and how they dispose them.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you, Senator Rosen, for the question. And Mr. Hickel can probably comment a little bit more, but, you know, there's some things we like to be first in and some things we don't like to be first in this state. But I think that we could brag that we are the leading recycling state in the nation. Our rates right now are up around 42-45%. There has been some debate whether that's stagnated or not. Some of that has to do with how we judge it, whether it's by weight and packaging. You know, manufacturers have been changing. If you'll notice, sometimes packaging changes, much to my chagrin sometimes, depending on what I'm buying. It gets lighter, or how we go through and product, you know, and design our products in this state. But I would argue, at least in terms of overall recycling, I think that we lead the nation. You know, and like I said, Mr. Hickel can comment a little bit more on other things. But, yeah, I think that we are the nation's leader.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
I, at risk of being redundant, I do want to point out that this will be a reduction in public revenue cost. This is the companies recycling their own products and reusing them instead of us paying to have them hauled away to a recycling center or a landfill or whatever. This will actually, I mean, right now you're paying for it already through your county taxes. So this should actually save money for the consumer.
We also had two others who wanted to testify, Senator Benson, Senator Brown, and then Mr. Bulish and Ms. Mendez. Welcome to the committee. Senator Benson, while we're...
Actually, Mr. Chair, and this might be to Mr. Quillis, I've talked with the paint, the ACA, the American Coating Association, and they seem in agreement. I had a question about carpet. Are there small manufacturers of carpets who might have a hard time implementing a recycling program? Because lots of times it's easier for big business to conform, and they come up with good ideas, and they can push downstream to their retailers a recycling program. But for a smaller carpet manufacturer, that might be difficult. But I don't know the industry well, and I'm wondering if that's something that
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, I don't either, and I think that's part of the uniqueness of it, that there are different sizes of retailers, different sizes of manufacturers, and I think that Ms. Mendez can comment on that. I think that she is here to comment on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Benson.
Wait for my answer. Thank you.
Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Eaton, you commented that this is going to save money, and the way I see it, and I'm not saying it's wrong, but it seems to be moving a back-end expense to the front-end expense, that we're paying for it when we buy it instead of paying for it when we want to get rid of it. But my question is, because Minnesota is a leader in recycling, is there no other way we can accomplish these types of things without the government mandating them?
Senator Brown, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, the difference is, from what your first comment, is that if I don't buy paint, I don't have to pay for the recycling of it. Right now, we're all paying for everybody's paint to be recycled. So I just want to point that out. And then as far as this has been an agreement between these different manufacturers and organizations and the state. I don't think that we'd be trying to mandate it if we didn't have the like the paint community and the carpet community and so on working with us. It's been a lot of negotiation over the years. The paint part has passed twice in the Senate in the past.
Let's have some of the other witnesses, Mr. Foolish and Ms. Mendez. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. With your permission, my name is Mark Kohorst. I may not be on your list. I'm here representing the manufacturers of the U.S. manufacturers of primary batteries. I'm senior manager for environment, health, and safety at the National Electrical Manufacturers Association. I came at the very last minute. My plane was delayed. It might be why my name is not on your list, but I'm here with one of our member company representatives to address the aspect of this bill of SF 639 related to primary batteries. I specifically representing, NEMA, National Electrical Manufacturers Association, is the principal trade association representing the electrical products industry. And I'm here today on behalf of several members of our primary battery manufacturing section, specifically Energizer, P&G Duracell, and Panasonic. And I'm joined by one of our member company representatives, and you'll hear from him directly in a moment. I just want to speak generally about the context of this bill and the motivation for it with regard to batteries. Before I do, I just want to emphasize, as Mr. Hickel did from PCA, that this is, we are talking about commonly used household batteries, AA, AAA, CD, and so forth. These are primary or single-use batteries. Obviously, the primary battery sector and the rechargeable battery sector are related. They overlap somewhat, but there are very important distinctions that affect the policy arena, and that's why we're only dealing with one sector of the industry now. The primary battery manufacturers have a very impressive record of product stewardship and sustainability measures, and have worked proactively for decades to address any sort of potential human health and environmental issues associated with their products. Two decades ago, the primary battery industry was the largest industrial consumer of mercury because virtually all of these household batteries contained a sizable amount of mercury in them to help control the buildup of gas and pressure within the container. In the mid-1990s, however, the manufacturers developed alternative technologies that allowed them to remove the mercury completely. The addition of mercury to alkaline and carbon zinc batteries, and those are the technologies, was actually made illegal then following that effort by the industry in 1996 under the federal battery legislation. The only batteries left that contain mercury are the small miniature batteries that someone mentioned earlier, so-called button or coin cell. And the industry has pledged publicly to eliminate mercury in those batteries by January 2015. And they are on course to meet that goal. So this bill today addresses another important sustainability issue, and that is proper management and disposal of these alkaline and carbon zinc batteries at end of life. And we appreciate PCA's focus on these products, and we've begun working with them on changes to the language that you see in front of you to address what we think are some of the most important considerations in a bill like this. Our first principal issue that we intend to have the bill address is that this law must ensure a level playing field, meaning that most, if not all, the parties that are responsible for putting the batteries in the market face the same obligation. And this is to address what is commonly known as a free rider issue. That begins with the NEMA manufacturers, but it extends to certain other suppliers and manufacturers of products that contain removable batteries. The second issue that we intend to emphasize in this legislation is that the program needs to be economically sustainable for manufacturers. And this will be established mainly by ensuring this level playing field that I just mentioned, and to ensure that the burden of the system is not borne by a limited or very small portion of the industry. And finally, we are seeking to structure the program so that it ensures the batteries are collected, processed in the most environmentally protective and efficient manner. Our industry, as Mr. Bullish will explain in a moment, has explored the collection methods and recycling technologies throughout the world, and we know an awful lot about this. It's part of an industry effort towards developing a nationally focused program for collecting these batteries. It's been underway for several years. My colleague will explain this in a moment. So in summary, the companies I mentioned are very supportive of the effort to craft a collection framework for primary batteries that meets these goals. And that's the emphasis of our involvement in the legislative development. We've explored, we hope very much to reach agreement on this language with PCA, and we'll be working with them closely towards that end. That concludes my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cohurst. We have your colleague is from EverReady, was Energizer, whatever it's called.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Mark Bullish. I am the president of the Corporation for Battery Recycling, as well as the director of regulatory affairs for Energizer. CBR, or the Corporation for Battery Recycling, is a not-for-profit organization set up by Duracell, Energizer, and Panasonic to manage our collection and recycling work in the U.S. market. We've been in place since about 2011, but our industry has been very involved in legislative and environmental issues with batteries dating back decades. In particular, we've been dealing with collection and recycling issues with batteries since the mid-1990s with the advent of a handful of laws in the European Union. Around that same time, a new tool was being developed called life cycle analysis, or LCA, which takes a look at the benefit of recycling products in the market. And between 2000 and 2006, there were a handful of life cycle assessments that were done in the European Union on primary batteries that showed at that time that the collection and recycling of primary batteries was actually a net negative for the environment. Although between 2000 and 2006, we showed that level decreasing and it was moving more towards a neutral proposition. Because of this, our industry in the U.S. market, or really in the North American market, decided to conduct a life cycle analysis with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology that we completed in 2008. While that study also showed that the current recycling infrastructure in North America was a net negative, particularly because of the amount of energy that's used to process batteries, it did show in some of the work that we did that if we carefully craft our program with a menu of options and take the best of those options, we could get to an environmentally neutral or even positive proposition. Because of this, we got our company presidents together, and in 2010, we agreed to start working on a program for the U.S. We started this in 2011 with a stakeholder summit where we invited 75 different stakeholders from around the country to help us form the framework for a national program. Originally, this program was scheduled to start in 2013, actually next month, and we originally had six tenets to this program. We wanted a program that had net environmental benefit or a goal of getting to that or a vision of getting there. We wanted a program that was industry or multi-industry led. We wanted a program with shared responsibility, which is a term that the paint folks used as well. And by this, we're not necessarily always meaning a financial shared responsibility. It just means that, for example, a program cannot work if a consumer does not take their battery and put it in a collection box. That part would be the consumer's part to play. So there's different levels of responsibility for different parties. We also wanted to have non-fragmented programs. It's difficult for us to deal with different programs in different states or different regions, so we wanted to try to avoid that. And we also wanted to have a phased implementation so that we could learn from what we're doing and be nimble enough to make changes should it be necessary. Originally, we also had a sixth tenet, which was voluntary program. and I'll get into that in a moment. It is important to note, and I thought you would be interested to know, that as Mr. Hickel mentioned, that one of our foundation programs, as we call them, where we're testing and learning to try to modify our program, is actually based locally here in Hennepin County. And they've been very helpful to us and given us quite a bit of information with our partners from MIT in helping develop our program. About 6 months ago, we changed our direction to focus on a legislated program. This was because as we started looking at what a program would look like, we realized that somewhere between 30 and 35% of the batteries that were sold into the U.S. market were what we call free riders or from companies that were not interested in participating in our program. That presents a huge problem for us because if we are then collecting and paying for the batteries that are end up in our collection bins, it puts us at a huge competitive disadvantage. And to give an idea, we were conducting battery sorts at all of our different programs around the country, and for just AA batteries alone, we found over 195 brands, almost 200. It was 196 to be exact. So in order to make a program equitable, that's why we moved from a voluntary to a legislated direction. We are working collaboratively with MPCA, and we are certainly hopeful we can reach a consensus for a system that works in Minnesota. And with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Bulish. Questions from the committee? If not,
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In light of the direction that you were going down before you started to look at a legislative program, would it be safe to say that a simpler legislative program is simply making the collection or the of them or participation in this mandatory and let the industry continue on with what you were planning to do rather than us getting government too heavily involved in it?
Mr. Bulish. Mr. Coerst.
Well, that's certainly an option. Mr. Chair and Senator Weber, that's certainly an option. The framework that was put together and proposed initially by PCA is not too distinct. It's not too different from the parameters of the program that the industry had already been devising or envisioning. So that's why, you know, we're sort of still within that framework and working on some of the specifics there. But, you know, we don't necessarily – the industry does not necessarily have an objection to a structured program as long as it meets our general – the general priorities that I mentioned in my testimony.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I simply bring it up from testimony at the solar hearing the other day where they were referring to the Germany program where actually it worked better when government got out of the way. And that's why I bring it up here.
Understood. I would add also, Mr. Chair and Senator, that our model is for primary batteries only. We do not consider this to be applicable, to be widely applicable to across product categories. I share the gentleman from the chamber, I share his view. NEMA has always shared the view that every product in the market that it's sold in is distinct and has its own characteristics. So what may work for batteries, for example, may or may not work at all for thermostats, for paint, for light bulbs. I mean, name your product.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
I just wanted to interject that is why we're doing product stewardship, because the experts of the product they're producing is the industry, and so they would be helping develop this whole process.
Ms. Mendez?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you and to speak today. My name is Jennifer Mendez. I am with the Carpet and Rug Institute. We are the trade association that represents the carpet manufacturers in the United States. About 97% of what you walk on in the United States is made in the United States. We're very proud to say that. We have not gone offshore, and we're still manufacturing in the United States. Our industry has always been a leader in sustainability from our Green Label Plus, which deals with indoor air quality, to the national, the carpet sustainability standard, the NSF 140, and the CARE organization that was referenced earlier today, that is the Carpet America Recovery Effort. It was a voluntary organization that was put together, started by industry and together with government and NGOs to work together to find voluntary market-driven solutions to carpet recycling, to diverting carpet from landfills specifically. And since 2002, we've diverted 2.5 billion pounds of carpet from landfill. It's a statistic we're very proud of. Carpet does take up 2% of the space in the landfill, but it is not hazardous waste. I wanted to make that clear. And the industry has already invested millions of dollars in finding solutions and how to keep carpet out of the landfill. So we are in opposition of this bill, SF-639. The CARE organization is currently working on programs in California, which was referenced. It was a California bill, AB 2398, and we are still in the process of seeing how that plays out. We're currently looking into how it works in the rural counties because that would be probably a more adequate comparison of how it might work in Minnesota. In New Jersey, CARE is working on developing a plan for curbside collection. And Delaware has actually put together a carpet recycling subcommittee that's working on putting a report back to the Senate Environment Committee there. So our focus hasn't been state-specific at CARE, but it's been to work across the board to find things that will work across the nation. And CARE's strength comes from its volunteers and its market-based solutions. There are a number of things that post-consumer carpet can be turned into. Artificial hay bales for sediment control, resin parts under the hood of a Ford F-150 are often made from post-consumer carpet, sound barriers along highways, artificial railroad ties and decking. So we also are hoping with the market-driven approach and the voluntary program to find uses for those products that the post-consumer carpet is turned into. We do have concerns with SF-639, and those include the added cost that would be added to the cost of carpet. As you've discussed, the fee would be added at the beginning. We also have a concern that that the fee would not be visible to the consumer, and we want the consumer to realize what they are paying for. The issue of rural collection is something that concerns us. When we do something, we want to be able to do it right and do it well. And currently, our industry has really taken a hit due to the downturn in the housing industry. And until that turns around, it's a very tough economy to be selling things that go in new homes and refurbished homes. And so we just don't think it's the right time. We just learned of this bill several weeks ago. It sounds like the other industries have had the opportunity to really work with MPCA, and we just have not had that opportunity. So at this point, we'd really like to oppose the bill and just say that we think our voluntary program is working, and we'd like you to continue to engage with that.
Thank you, Ms. Mendez. Questions from the committee? Senator Sieben.
Well, Mr. Chair and Ms. Mendez, then, could you describe what your organization is doing to get carpet out of landfills here in Minnesota currently?
Well, it's not doing anything Minnesota-specific. It's doing things across the states. And what CARE provides is support and guidance to collectors and recyclers. It offers a network. It offers equipment and processing, access to those sorts of things, networking and connections, outlets for your the products and new technology, and particularly the opportunity to talk about what to do with PET, because even within the carpet, you heard Mr. Cohorse say that every product is unique. Even within carpet itself, there are different fibers that the carpet is made out of, and some are more easily recyclable than others, and PET is one of the more difficult ones.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Sieben.
Ms. Mendez, I appreciate that you only learned about the bill several weeks ago. It looks like, though, that in reviewing the bill, your organization would have substantial ability to weigh in with the Pollution Control Agency and help develop a stewardship plan that could help work for the industry. So I just encourage you to, you know, take this on. And I understand you want a nationwide solution, but this might be a good opportunity to work with an agency that's saying in this legislation that they want to work with your industry to find a solution that has the end goal, which you also support, which is getting carpet out of landfills and responsibly recycled. So I would hope that you would work diligently to do that if this legislation is passed.
Further discussion on the bill? Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Mendez, my earlier question had been to Mr. Quillis. Are there small manufacturers who would have a hard time pushing a recycling program downstream to their retail outlets?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, thank you for the question. There are no mills in Minnesota that we are aware of that are members of our organization. Generally, the mills are fairly large, but it is costly and it's difficult to educate the consumers, and it's costly to the manufacturer on the front end. So it doesn't really make any difference what size the manufacturer is. It would be a challenge.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to comment on the bill in general, I think we all are in agreement with the desired end results of this bill, Senator Eaton, and I want to share with you that I would like to achieve those end results too. But I do think there are issues that have been raised that are significant. I think Ms. Mendez's comment about the rural sector is an issue. I was actually, as a member of local government, I was involved when we implemented recycling in general back home, and transportation of us being able to move our recycled products is an issue, and it is a cost, and it is something that is significant in the overall ability to make a program successful. I think that we have also recognized, as we've dealt with these three particular industries, that each of the industries are at different levels in terms of their overall approach to the recycling issue. But the significant thing is that all three of them are working on it. And I think that's significant, and I think that's noteworthy, and I am much more comfortable with the industry that knows their product being able to accomplish that in the most significant and cost efficient manner as relates to our consumers here in Minnesota, and I guess what I'm simply saying is that I think we should give them the time to work that out and to achieve that type of success. And as we look as elected officials at the needs of the state, and as we look at no matter which committees we're serving on, there are significant needs that are presenting themselves for additional spending and increasing the cost of government. And I think as long as we have industries that are actually working on it, to us to dedicate resources to accomplishing what the industry itself is willing to and able to accomplish, I don't necessarily believe is good stewardship of the funds that we have control over. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Mr. Chair, I just counter that a little bit, what Senator Weber just said, because I think I heard Ms. Mendez say that they're not doing anything here in Minnesota. They're working perhaps on a national scale, but nothing here in Minnesota that's specifically helping get more carpet out of our landfills. So I appreciate that the Pollution Control Agency and Senator Eaton are stepping forward and saying, if we pass this legislation, we'll require a product stewardship plan that works with industry to come up with a solution that can work across the state. And, I acknowledge that there may be a 5-cent per yard fee involved that is not yet defined. But I think in the overall scheme of thing, if you're looking at funding 1.5 full-time employees, in relation to that, we'll certainly have to see the fiscal note, but it doesn't seem like it's an exceptionally high price to pay for something that, at least with carpet, doesn't seem to have a good solution here in Minnesota right now.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
I think you all have the carpet stewardship profile sheet, and I'd like to point out at the bottom there that 382 tons of carpet were collected in 2011 from seven counties. So we are dealing with it. We're paying for it anyway. We're paying for it with property taxes, and we're paying for it with other local expenditures because we are collecting the carpet. We are disposing of it. And this would create a method for it to be recycled, reused, and not fill up our landfills.
Senator Benson and Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to address some of what Senator Sieben had talked about, we have three industries at very different points in their recycling maturity. And if you look at the battery industry, they're not going to deal with the small button batteries, and they're not dealing specifically with recycled batteries. They're dealing with a category of batteries that they're ready to manage. And so they're ready to come forward and have the government put a uniform standard on the industry. And then the paint, the Coatings Association are ready to come forward and have a segment of their industry made uniform through this regulation, but they're not going to touch aerosols. But I don't hear that kind of accommodation for the carpet industry. There's a difference between nylon and PET, and so it seems like maybe the carpet industry isn't at a recycling maturity where they're ready to have some uniform standard imposed, and it sounds like we might need a little more work on the carpet industry, even if the other two are ready to move forward. And I'm wondering, Senator Eaton, if you had considered that or would look into that so that they have some time to catch up.
Senator Eaton.
I strongly support this bill in the way it's drafted.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to give a special note to the Brotex Incorporated because I've used their products before. And I just think it's a good example for the future to have a 90-year-old company in Minnesota that's willing to tackle this and says that they can actually employ more people. He said that they could add 15 jobs if they were going to recycle carpet. And it sounds as though we have somebody here in our state, a 90-year-old company that I know of their products. They're a good example of what we have to do if there hasn't been a solution. There is a possible solution, and they're willing to work on it. I just think it's good for this bill. I think the bill would be good, and I think that companies like Brotex will be the future of Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question: is Ms. Garlett still in the room? I guess I just had a question because Senator Eaton has referred to a couple of times of the recycling and the cost, and that this could reduce costs. And I'm just wondering if Ms. Garlett actually sees the possibility of counties being able to lower their levies on their county taxpayers as a result of this bill.
Maybe more recycling fees that people pay than property tax. We have a woman from the Solid Waste Coordinating Board. Welcome back.
Well, here's Anna Lee also, so either way.
Hey, just go ahead and sit down and present it. She wants to add comments.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator Weber. That nationally, we calculate that it will reduce our costs by about 80%, so we will be left with 20%. So there will be significant savings. The counties in the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, using a formula for calculating costs for paint recycling, came up with a cost per unit of from $5 to $7, depending on each of the county's programmatic programs, quantities, comprehensiveness of what they were doing. And so you're talking significant dollars that this will save local government, this will save taxpayers for manufacturers to step up.
For the record, you're Trudy Richter.
Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you, Senator Marty.
Thank you. Senator Eaton, is there further discussion? Not Senator Eaton, move Senate File 6. 39 as amended be recommended pass. And this goes, I believe, to judiciary unless you've heard some other committee.
As far as I know.
On that motion, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No. No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
One more bill, Senate File 510.
It's always nice to have a little help from your friends.
Next up, we have Senator Marty with Senate File 510, City Solid Waste Collection Process Modification and Organized Collection Committee's Establishment. Senator Marty, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Please, can I have some... thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 510 is a bill that would change the procedures in the way that cities or townships would organize for organized collection of solid waste if they choose to do so. And before I get into the bill, I do have an A2 amendment I'd like to offer. If that could be distributed, I wanted to make one oral amendment to that.
Senator Marty, members, is the they're handing it out.
I'll go through the bill while we're waiting on that. A little bit about the purpose of the bill. I know from my own experience in my own neighborhood, and we all have our own examples. My neighborhood, the city I live in, has all the trash collected in various neighborhoods one day of the week, which means we have 7 or 8 trucks going down our street on Wednesday mornings. We don't have sidewalks, so the school kids wait for the bus in the street. You have 7 trucks running down the street. You have 7 times as much chance somebody's going to be hit. You have a lot more air quality questions from that many trucks driving along. You have that much more road damage and so on. And a number of cities have been, over the years, have been deciding maybe it makes more sense to organize their collection. And City of Maplewood did that a year or two ago. Sauk Rapids City Council recently moved to do so. And I think you'll be getting some information on that. But since the amendment, I'm assuming, has been passed out now, on line 9 of the amendment, I wanted to delete the word small businesses and replace it with the word independent.
Members,
I'd like to move the amendment with that incorporated in it.
Thank you. Senator Marty moves. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senator Marty.
Thank you. And I will have some witnesses speak to the bill, and I can go into more detail about the arguments for it. It is a question of doing the smartest way of protecting our roads and public safety and the environment. And it just happens to be far cheaper. The article you have on the recent Sauk Rapids decision, I know that some of the haulers had gotten involved in the campaign. I believe there, and 2 of the council members were defeated. The new ones came in, and they looked at the evidence, and they decided to go along with it, too. One of the council members says he'll personally save $256 a year. They talked about it. Everybody saves money in the process. One council member said his bill would go down from $30 a month to $12 a month. So it's a huge cost savings in addition to the environmental benefits. And with the amendment on the bill, basically what would happen is that for a city or township to organize collection, they would have to, by ordinance, establish a committee to examine and evaluate various methods of organized collection. You can see that in subdivision 4A. Paragraph B, the committee is subject to the open meeting law, so they would have to, their meetings would all be publicly posted. The committee would be required, as you can see under Section 3, to determine best method of collecting waste in the community and you can see all the requirements there. They would have to be getting input from, get a minimum from the governing body, from the city council or township board, from those, the local folks involved in solid waste issues, those who are haulers and so on, and residents of the community. Then they'd issue a report, and then under Section 4, the governing body would have to, when review the report, and have to hold at least a public hearing. We have added in the amendments a provision that preference may be given to haulers that are small businesses and agree to remain independent for the terms of the contract. And the organized collection could begin no earlier than six months after this was all completed. And with that, I'd like to have some brief testimony from Mr. Johnson from the League of Cities.
Mr. Craig Johnson, welcome. And for the record, please state your name and where you're from. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. For those of you who are not familiar with our organization, we're the statewide association representing the cities of Minnesota. There's 834 of them, and 820 of those are members of ours. The ones that aren't are under 100 in population and have no staff or facilities that they are concerned about. So the League is very supportive of Senator Marty's Bill 510. We are mandated under state law, cities, any city over 1,000 is required to provide and assure through enforcement that garbage is collected from all the residents and businesses in their community. It is not an option. You can't decide as a city you're not interested in dealing with garbage. You must do it. So the state further encourages cities to look at doing organized collection to have a better control of how garbage is managed. But the process that's been in place for 20 years is a very restrictive six-month process that's laid out in the section of law that's being amended by this bill. The current process requires 180 days. It requires very specific creation of a panel that includes all licensed solid waste haulers in the area. And essentially, if a majority of those haulers do not agree to the final plan that's put together, it actually causes a lot of problems for completing the plan. It also, of course, has two 90-day requirements, one for negotiations and one for consideration of those negotiations. And what Senator Marty's bill really does is simply says, yes, we do need to have a good process that does have public meetings, public notice, public involvement to look at how we collect solid waste in our communities, but it doesn't have to be that restrictive, and it can be done the same way we make our other local government decisions. Because what this really is about a bidding process for a mandatory local government service. If we are busy putting forward a contract for road repairs in the community to private vendors, we do that to make sure we get the service done by the time we need and the cost that's best for the public, and we put that out for bid to do that. That's what this is really making possible with solid waste collection, that a community can very effectively put a discussion together and make a local decision, a local ordinance to work on that. Situation right now is that communities have a lot of different things that work best in their community. It depends on the number of haulers. It depends on the size of the community. And we have a lot of different issues. Some communities have their garbage collected in alleys, and the alleys are gravel or dirt alleys. Large trucks do a tremendous amount of wear on those, and they might have concerns related to that.
Senator Osmick?
Mr. Chair and to Mr. Johnson, so you're equating road reconstruction with the choice of a garbage hauler? Is that what I just heard you say?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I am equating the need of a city to figure out how best to provide those services, but not the actual contract itself. We are mandated to come up with solid waste services, and a similarity would be that if my company that does road repairs was contracted this year to do the road repairs, and next time we had road repairs in town, I didn't win the bid, another company would get that bid. That's kind of the argument that is at the crux of organized solid waste collection is, do we have the community set up a process to put those bids out and let everyone have their shot at those bids, or do we have every individual person in the town make a decision and not have the local government involved in what is a mandate of local government is to come up with how to service solid waste collection. So I did not mean to imply it's the same as servicing a road in any way, except that it's a decision local governments have to make about a service that they have to provide.
Well, Mr. Chair, in just response to
Mr.
that.
Mr. Johnson, Senator Osmick.
They're entirely different animals. They're entirely different animals. When you're doing a road reconstruction project, you do go out to bid, and you look for the best cost, or you look for the not just the best cost, but also some of them provide quality. You have an incredibly large economy of scale when you're dealing with multi-million dollar road reconstructions, and people don't have the ability to pick and choose who's going to service the 30 feet or the 80 feet in front of their property because of the economy of scale. With a garbage hauler, this is something where you can pick and choose a different service because you have the freedom in this nation to pick the service that provides you the best quality or the best service. And you're equating two things. You're equating an apple, in my opinion, you're equating an apple and a steak. Granted, they're both in the same ballpark, but they're not remotely close from a civic standpoint. Believe me, take it from me as a former city councilman, they're not even remotely close. So I just like to point that out.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, very much respect your background and experience as a city official. I would respectfully disagree in some aspects of that. The real issue at stake here is, as you said, looking at how we get the best service on this for the community and where we can, through economy of scale, get the better deal for the taxpayers and the ratepayers of this required utility in our city. If you look at what happened in Sauk Rapids, you can see it, that people thought they had a good deal getting their individual waste picked up by individual haulers when the city created the economy of scale through a contract for the entire community. They actually got a rate that was $250 to $350 per household lower, and they expanded the service provided. I think you'll hear more of that from the city of Maplewood when they testify. Just the economy of scale thing that you're talking about does work with solid waste, too. That is something that's similar in it. But I do understand they're not the same, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Senator Brown has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, to expand on what Senator Osmick was asking, what other bidding processes do cities issue where it's the residents who are paying the monthly bill of that bidding process?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, it would depend on what utilities are set up in that community, but anytime we are putting any public service up for bid, the citizens of the city are the ones that end up paying for it, whether it's through a utility fee because it's a utility or whether it's through their property taxes paying for the service. That's the only thing we have to spend is that local government money. So,
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Senator Brown, do a follow-up, and then I just want to remind the committee that we have 15 minutes and there are four people slated to talk. So if we could hold these questions maybe till the end, that would help the system go longer. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, I understand that, but this is something where citizens have had the right for, I believe you said, 20 years to make their choice. Not everybody wants the low-cost option on trash hauling. They may have other reasons for why they choose a different hauler. And not everything the city issues that is the residents are not paying a monthly bill for that. I understand it may be through property taxes or assessments or so forth. But in this instance, the residents are paying a monthly bill for a service from which they get to choose who they want to hire to do that service.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it is true that in some communities, doing organized collection is a change from what they're doing. I would point out that we have many communities that have always had organized collection. It's always been under a contract or municipally collected. And in fact, the League in its annual survey of cities included questions on this last year. Of the 391 cities that replied, 250 responded that they are using organized collection for either solid waste or recycling right now. So many, many communities are already under this. The 20 years that I referenced is how long this special process to go into organized collection has been in place. Prior to that, if a community decided they wanted to restrict garbage hauling or do different types of contracting, they just did it the same way they do any other local decision. They posted a public notice, had a public hearing, took a vote. So the 20 years is how long the current statute with the 180-day process has been in place. So, Mr. Chair, just to complete, I have only a couple other comments on my testimony. You can hear from a city that actually has been through this. There's a number of other benefits that cities are looking at when they're doing this. As you see in the Sauk Rapids example, they achieved a significant reduction in their utility costs for the solid waste costs for their residents, up to between $240 and $350 per household. We see that frequently. We also see regularly the ability to get other services that they normally aren't getting as an individual bidder. Because, again, of the economy of scale, senior citizens in Sauk Rapids will have their garbage picked up from their garage. They don't have to push the carts out to the curb any longer. We get better recycling in many communities where they get a wider scale of products collected than they otherwise were able to get. And we also have the ability to work to reduce the wear and tear on the roads, the public safety concerns and infrastructure wear concerns related to that. Even some communities have other environmental benefits they're looking for, like reducing the number of truck trips in their community for air emissions and other purposes that this helps them achieve. In conclusion, I would just say that this does not eliminate a process. It still requires the full public process, public hearings, involvement of all the stakeholders. All that this is doing is removing the mandate of the 180 days and the two specific mandates of 90-day windows of hearing time, and otherwise is still a required public process you would have to do before you can go to an organized collection system. Just in closing, there are several types of organized collection systems. They are referenced in the bill, but just to be clear, you can have a single hauler that does your whole city. You could have multiple haulers that do chunks of the city. It breaks into zones. You could have a group of haulers form a consortium and do a joint bid together to cover the city and split it up amongst themselves in how they're going to do it. And you can have municipal collection that just covers the whole city. And we have all of those in many communities throughout the state.
Mr. Johnson, thank you for your testimony. Before we get to Ms. Finwell, Senator Benson did have one question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is actually to Mr. Johnson. I don't see that we have a problem. Given the response of the number of your cities that have already managed their way through this process, it seems like the city councils are getting through this just fine. My city has multiple collectors divided up the city. They managed to do it without coming to St. Paul to solve the problem. And so I don't see that this is a place for St. Paul to be making changes if we've got more than 50%. I think it was upwards of 70% of your respondents have already handled this process. And so can you please tell me why St. Paul needs to be involved in this? It seems like something that can be easily managed at the city council level.
Senator Benson, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator, thank you for the question. I neglected to put that in my comments and should have. This is actually very significantly needed. In the 20 years that 180-day process has been in place, Maplewood, which completed this process 2 years ago, was the first city to successfully get through that process. The others, 20-some that I'm aware of, I don't have a record exactly of how many there were, the Pollution Control Agency may, did not successfully complete getting through that 180-day process because of the time involved, the amount of campaigning done at the local level involved, the fact that, you know, people get very excited about these issues, as you've heard. It's an emotional issue, and it does affect local people. I mean, it's a real issue. We have a lot of these that happen at the city level. But the reason we are asking for these changes is to make it – we now have had, in 20 years, two cities successfully get through this. The other cities that I've mentioned all have had organized collection prior to that hearing process being in place. That's the only ones that have added it in that time period. So the need is to make a process that actually allows cities – to more readily address this if it's something that their elected leaders decide is something they need to pursue in their community.
Mr. Johnson, thank you for your testimony. Ms. Finwall, welcome to the committee. Tell us who you are for the record and where you're from.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, my name is Sean Finwall, and I'm an environmental planner with the City of Maplewood. And I have been invited here today to talk about Maplewood's efforts to organize its solid waste hauling and our trials and tribulations of that effort. So in Maplewood, again, we were the first city in 20 years to organize trash collection within the state of Minnesota under the current statute. So I just want to brief you on Maplewood, if you weren't familiar. We're that funny-shaped city that's located just east of St. Paul. We have a population of 38,000 people. And if you're still unfamiliar, here's a few landmarks. We have 3M headquarters just north of 94, and on our northern end, we have the regional mall, Maplewood Mall. And a little bit of history on Maplewood solid waste. Our organized recycling program we have had for over 30 years. So we've had an actual organized recycling program where we go out for RFPs every three years to obtain bids to get the best pricing for our residents for that recycling program. The previous solid waste ordinance prior to our organization was adopted in 1992, and that ordinance was really a compromise from what was supposed to be an organized system back in 92. The city attempted to organize, but based on compromises with the haulers at the time, we created this ordinance, which I think the biggest thing was it allowed for open hauling. Currently, we have 9 residential licensed haulers within the city of Maplewood, and residential properties have to have their trash picked up at least once a week. And then, again, the biggest thing was this day-certain trash and recycling pickup schedule. So instead of just the haulers picking up the trash any day of the week, we had them modified so it was just different neighborhoods for different days. So that was, I think, the biggest change there. But what we saw, the problems with our open hauling system, I think one of the biggest things that came from a grassroots effort from many of our residents in 2009-10, because of the economy, the city was able to obtain really low bids on our street projects. So we were really ramping up our street efforts, our street reconstruction efforts. And in Maplewood, you're assessed for that street reconstruction. So what residents were seeing was, you know, this $6,000 possible assessment. And then once the road was complete, they saw all these trash trucks, which are, of course, the heaviest vehicle on the roads, and wondering, you know, so am I going to have to pay for this now in another 10 years, or if we had reduced trucks, would this last for 30 years? So we really heard some calls from residents to take a look at that. And then our Environmental and Natural Resources Commission, who is a group of appointed individuals who look at environmental issues in the city, they chose this as one of their top goals for several years, and they really looked at things like the increased emissions with the multiple trucks, the multiple trash haulers picking up trash. So it's a really inefficient system. In Maplewood, we have over 40 cul-de-sacs, which is quite common in suburbs. So you can see here an example on this cul-de-sac on a trash pickup morning. If you're sitting out there drinking your coffee, you could see, in this case, as many as 7 haulers just ramping around that cul-de-sac picking up your trash. So it does cause a lot of, you know, issues with noise and emissions and so forth. So other issues were lack of control to meet mandates. You know, there's a lot of mandates that are put on by a city to manage its solid waste, including recycling and trash. And what we found was that many of the haulers, you know, they weren't bringing the trash to the RRT facility for, you know, sorting and to be burned for fuel. Many of them in the open hauling system still possibly were bringing them, you know, across the Wisconsin border to a landfill. So we weren't able to really control or manage our solid waste very well. So once it came to the city council level, the city council kind of switched the goals, and their top priority was, you know, we want to study our trash hauling system. We're just going to study it. We just want to look at it because we haven't looked at it since 1992. And here's the goals once we look at it. We want to make sure that the economics make sense, that there's ultimate service levels for our residents. We want to make sure the environmental impacts are lessened, that it's a safe system. And then the items that have an asterisk next to them, those are actually required in the statute to ensure an efficient process, to ensure that you follow a planning process. And then we added aesthetics because, as you saw from that cul-de-sac example, having all those multiple haulers can affect the aesthetics of your city. And then really looking at how all of this will affect our haulers, our 9 residential licensed haulers. We were looking at organizing our single-family residential. So where do we begin? you look at the statute which is in place, 115A.94, and it was kind of a daunting task as an environmental planner, you know, put in my position to deal with recycling and to look at developments to make sure they're meeting environmental requirements, to suddenly see this huge undertaking that now the city council wants us to look at, you know, researching and studying our trash system. Well, I had to really educate myself on the statute. And, of course, there's this 180-day minimum process, so a city cannot organize within 180 days of, you know, passing that resolution of intent to organize, which requires this public hearing before you even decide, you know, that you're going to organize. You just want to study it. And then there's this planning period and negotiation period and then findings. So the city council did hold that public hearing to adopt a resolution of intent to organize, and just the name of that resolution in and of itself, you know, incites fear from the haulers, not fear, but, you know, concern, I should say, concern from the haulers and from the residents who, you know, support those haulers. So based on this, you know, we are required to notify the public within like 10 days of this public hearing. So it gave the haulers time to come out in force and, you know, really get the residents concerned about what the city council was attempting to do, which was really just to study the issue. So during that public hearing, we did have about 175 very angry residents and haulers, and it was a very difficult process to maneuver. So once we did adopt that resolution of intent to organize, now what do we do? We, of course, followed that organized collection statute to the best of our ability, but since no other city has followed that to its completion within 20 years, we were a little bit confused as to where to begin. So I think the first thing that we did, because we're not experts in this area, is we did hire a consultant. And we did use some of our SCORE funding for that initial planning process. We used up to $60,000. And Ramsey County also offered technical assistance because they determined that a portion of our study would increase the recycling rates. So they offered that $40,000 of technical assistance. So this basically one-year process cost, you know, a considerable amount of money. And then we did start with meeting one-on-one with all of the haulers, which was an important piece to our council. We wanted to ensure that we're inclusive of all the haulers and obtain their, you know, insights into the city's systems and the city council's concerns with the way things were going in our current open hauling.
Ms. Finwell, senators, we're coming up on our time, but I'm proposing we continue get through the
if we
four
have a chance,
Senator
depending
Marty
on how fast she and the other two witnesses, maybe we go about 5 minutes extra, or so we probably will have to. We're not going to meet tonight because there is a subcommittee meeting tonight. So what we'll do is at least let's finish her testimony, and if anybody else can do it quickly, we could do that. Otherwise, we'll just continue on the first thing on the next agenda.
Senator Marty, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Marty. I think obviously there's a lot more questions, and perhaps some other people would like to testify that came up as they did in this last bill. This is probably one of the more controversial bills. We've only had not even 30 minutes on it. So,
Senator Rosen, thank you. Yeah, we were slated for 40 minutes, and I believe we got a whole 20 minutes. So, you know, I didn't know battery discussion would be so hot. You know, it's like, but that's good. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Rosen. Senator Marty, Ms. Finwell.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just continue for a few more minutes. If Ms. Finwell can finish, and if either the others wanted to come up quickly, we could do that as well.
I'll be brief. Thank you. So, We formed this trash hauling working group. It was made up of our environmental commissioners and our city council, and we looked at ways of improving our existing system, and that included another tract, which is a feasibility of an organized system. In the improvements, so it was two tracts, really, that we were looking at. In the improvements to the existing system, we determined that in order to meet our goals, we'd really have to ramp up enforcement, which would mean an increase in licensing fees. We really wanted to see a better transparency in rates because haulers were required to report their rates, but what we had found is that they were not charging those same rates to our residents. And then another option was limiting the number of licenses. So the feasibility of an organized system, we did this request for proposal. We put that out, and we really wanted to make sure that we put everyone on a level playing field. So that included the small local haulers as well as the large haulers. So we had several options for proposals, citywide single hauler, districts, joint proposals, or a possibility of consortium. And then one of the big steps that the city took was we actually purchased the trash carts so the haulers wouldn't have that large investment. And then there was kind of this third track, which you don't, you know, it's not really outlined very well, but it's in the statute as far as engaging in anti-competitive conduct. We are waiting for this negotiation process to occur. But there really wasn't any cooperation from the haulers. They weren't interested in sitting down and helping the city meet its goals. What we found was that it was more of a pushback, so it was real difficult for the city. So we just continued on with our study process. And then we did receive six responses to that RFP. October of 2011, the City Council did authorize staff to negotiate a contract. And what we found, the findings as required by state statute, was the advantages of organizing was the lower prices, reduced truck traffic, community control over waste management decisions, and, of course, the big disadvantage with an organized system is residents have no they have the loss of individual choice, which was huge for many of the residents. But in December of 2011, the City Council did authorize a trash hauling contract with the top-rated proposer, and basically that was their decision to organize trash collection. And I included for you in your packet the findings that we had to outline, which, you know, the language was unclear as to what findings meant. But, you know, it's like a 12-page document that took me about 3 days to put together and present. So we have this trash hauling system now that started October of last year. It's a five-year contract. We have about 9,000 single-family residents with townhomes, manufactured homes, able to opt in. Again, the city purchased the carts, and the contractor does the billing. We had found through a study that the cost savings of this organized trash is $1.1 million per year, less than the current average published rates. And again, those are the rates that the haulers are supposed to give to the city yearly. And then we did a study on actual rates that were being charged to our residents, and we determined that it's actually a $1.6 million per year savings, less than the average actual rates. And since, you know, we have begun the organized collection, and I've talked to thousands of people, I think on average people are saving about 50 to 75% off of their monthly trash bill. So with that, here's an outline of the pricing for the per unit per month rates, about $679 to $1317, and that includes the taxes and this trash cart fee that we charge to cover our costs for the cart. So you can see that's considerably lower than, you know, the $20 to $40 monthly rates that our residents were seeing previously. And then finally, I just want to give some insights into the process, because it was a long, arduous process for the city, and some thoughts on the statute itself. That public hearing to adopt a resolution of intent to organize, just that, you know, to study a system, seemed like an unfair advantage for a city. I mean, it puts it's like the city having to put its cards out while the haulers, you know, are able to hold their cards in their hand. You know, we have to tell everyone everything that we're doing, and, you know, it's just a study. I mean, isn't it important for a city to have an efficient system of trash or whatever you might be doing? So to just study that, having that public hearing was really difficult. And then the language of the statute, you know, this planning period, the negotiation period, all that, it was just very difficult to follow that language. I mean, it was so difficult we had to hire a consultant to help us. And then those required timelines. Requiring that 160 days, you know, allows the haulers to join forces and put out information that might not have been as accurate as the city would have liked to see. So it really gets the residents kind of confused and put on the wrong information is out there. So I really appreciate your time in letting me explain our process. Since that time, it has been going well. We're into, month five, I think, of our organized trash. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Marty, what's the pleasure of, do you want to?
Mr. Chair, if there are any quick questions for her, maybe we could take them and then we'll adjourn because I don't think we'll have time for the other side today.
We have two, Senator Marty. We're going to start with, one. We're going to start with Senator Osmick.
I'd just like to point out to the members of the commission that there is a city council member of Maplewood. We passed out an email from him saying he disagrees with this legislation. I thought I'd just bring that up.
Thank you, Senator Osmick. That's here. And Senator Marty, if no other further questions,
Attorney,
then we're going to adjourn.
This up for the next meeting.
Next meeting. Thank you.